like to announce at the outset that Judge Stuckey has taken ill, nothing long-term, fortunately. He will participate in both of this morning's cases on the record. Our first case this morning is United States against Bear. Is defense ready to proceed? Please do so.
May it please the court. Chief Judge Efron, honorable judges of this court, good morning. I'm Major John Page, and along with Lieutenant Colonel Mark Strickland, we represent the appellant in this case, Staff Sergeant James Bear. The military judge in this case abused his discretion when he erroneously omitted testimony from KSB, appellant's sister, that approximately 12 years prior to the charged time frame, that the appellant had molested her over a period of time when he was beginning approximately at the ages of 15 or 16 years old and his sister was 8 years old. The military judge erroneously admitted this evidence under both Military Rule of Evidence 414 and 404B.
Can I just establish the facts to make sure there's no disagreement on the facts?
Yes, Your Honor.
As I read the briefs and the record, the appellant was either 15 or 16 at the time of the 414 acts. Is that correct?
Yes, sir, at the beginning of them.
And the acts continued until the appellant was 19?
Yes, Your Honor.
Is that a fair, and I'm not, this is not argument, this is just making sure I'm on the same sheet of music with both parties. The charge conduct occurred when he was 28. Is that accurate?
Yes, Your Honor.
And he's 34 at the age of trial?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
I'll address the MRA 414 aspect of the analysis first. Now, the case law makes clear that if evidence is propensity evidence that falls within MRA 414, the military judge still has to conduct a balancing test under Military Rule of Evidence 403 and examine the different factors that this court outlined in the United States versus Wright in determining whether or not that evidence should be presented to the fact finder. Now, while MRA 414 is a rule that favors the inclusion of evidence, the case law at the same time makes clear that the military judge would still apply a robust balancing test. For example, in United States versus Barry, this court emphasized that the military judge must still apply a thorough balancing test. And in a Federal Circuit Court of Appeals case, in United States versus Guardia, the court in that case made clear that there's no language in 414 that advocates an especially lenient or diluted application of the MRE 403 balancing test.
What are we to make of the fact that the defense counsel did not object to the evidence regarding TA?
That's
I mean,
right.
With respect to the balancing tests and both the balancing test issue and the prejudice, I mean, wasn't that sort of evidence, you know, the same as the evidence that you're complaining about?
Well, the key difference, Your Honor, was that the evidence regarding TLA more or less happened concurrently with the allegations of what happened with RMB. And so regarding TLA, there wasn't this
I'm talking specifically about the balancing test that you're talking about under 403.
Yes, Your Honor. Well, I think with TLA, you're correct that there was no objection from the defense with respect to TLA. I think the aspect with TLA versus RMB is that this evidence was happening at the same time, so you didn't have the right factor involved, the intervening circumstances, like you did between KSB and RMB. So that aspect, as far as the balancing test, wasn't something that was involved as it was with respect to the appellant's sister.
Has that been reason?
That was the primary aspect of it, Your Honor, one of the most important aspects. In the intervening circumstances involved as well.
Well, is there a difference in your mind between intervening circumstances and the time?
To a certain extent, yes, Your Honor.
Why don't you articulate that difference for me?
Yes, Your Honor. For example, if you had a case where
Somebody was an adult at 21 years old, and there was some evidence that they had engaged in sexual acts, some evidence of child molestation. And then 10 years later, when they're 31 years old, also an adult, there's acts that they're at that point charged with.
How about when they're age 19? You don't consider them an adult at age 19?
Well,
or, for example, an adult when they enter the armed forces? And I'm sorry to cut you off. I didn't want to steal your question, Judge Ryan. I just wanted to.
That's okay.
Yeah.
It could be, Your Honor. Obviously, each case is going to be different, but the reason we want to apply to the facts of this case specifically is regarding age 19, when the evidence indicated that the acts with KSB ended. The appellant at that point hadn't undergone any of the intervening, sort of the life-altering events that happened during the intervening period, for example.
They ended because he left, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And then they began, it appears when he had another child of the same age in proximity to him. So, what changed?
Well, during that intervening period, Your Honor, for example, Sergeant Bear, he moved out of the isolated home life that he had been living in prior to that point. He also, the record indicates, he got married. Obviously, he joined the Air Force. He established his own household. And during that 8-year time period, that's a significant period of time for him to, develop from being an adolescent when the incidents with KSB began and mature as an adult and develop and acquire a lot of those important life experiences that are important.
Okay, can I just return to the question I asked you earlier? I think that you're saying that your two arguments under 403 are that the military judge didn't consider the period of time between the acts with KSB and the acts of the victim in this case, and that secondly, that the military judge didn't adequately consider the intervening circumstances between those two periods of time?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, can you just, but you said that those are different things, and I'm just asking you to explain how they're different, because I'm not sure that I understood it.
Yes, Your Honor. I guess it's hard to, in a sense, they mesh together in terms of analyzing it. The period of time by itself, for example, in the hypothetical I started to give, if somebody was 21 during the uncharged incidents and then 31 during the charged incidents, there's not necessarily going to be that period where somebody is, like in this case, is beginning as an adolescent, or in the case of Barry, where somebody is beginning as a child at a younger age, and then they're maturing and developing into an adult. So in the hypothetical, you have somebody who's already in adulthood, they're not undergoing that same transformational time period that they would be, as we had in this case here with Sergeant Bear.
So you don't think that Barry is distinguishable from this case? It's not that there's no distinction between someone doing something when they're 13 and someone doing something between the ages of 16 and 19?
We would submit that the cases are quite similar, Your Honor.
I understand your position.
Well, in this case, where the most important right factor that the military judge failed to address in this case was the intervening circumstances. There was absolutely no analysis done by the military judge in his 403 balancing test as to how the intervening circumstances in this case impacted the admissibility of the evidence. And the key case to look at here is United States versus Barry. The military judge in this case failed to take into account that Sergeant Bear, beginning at the ages of 15 or 16 as an adolescent, failed to properly analyze the differences in his circumstances at that stage in his development versus his circumstances in his life as an adult in his late 20s. The evidence also indicated during the motion hearing.
Before you leave that, then, what specifically was put on the record that the military judge neglected to balance, in your view?
Your Honor, specifically what he didn't balance was, first of all, there was some testimony during the motion hearing that Sergeant Barr's father had apparently engaged in some sort of misconduct, some sort of a molestation act against another child, and had spent some time in prison for that. That was from the testimony of KSB. There was also some discussion regarding whether or not Sergeant Barr's father had molested him as a child. So the military judge did not take into consideration with Sergeant Barr in an environment as an adolescent where the examples that were being given to him was that, you know, either this was some kind of appropriate behavior to engage in. They did not analyze how, when Sergeant Barr moved out of that environment from living under his parents' household, once he joined the Air Force, was married, and grew into adulthood, how his mens rea at that stage compared with his mens rea as an adolescent.
And at what point in the record did the defense say to the military judge, these are the factors which should preclude its admission under 414 as balanced under 403?
At what point did the defense counsel?
Did the defense counsel specifically ask the judge to take those factors into account in the admissibility of 414 as balanced under 403?
As far as the motion hearing, Your Honor, I don't believe the trial defense counsel quite articulated it that clearly, but there was certainly some testimony, at least from the defense's expert witness, Dr. Youngren, who suggested that somebody who was molesting as an adult, it was certainly not necessarily the same as somebody as an adolescent, and that you certainly need to consider the environment that the adolescent is in, and if there's examples being given to the adolescent that that's perhaps appropriate behavior, that needs to be taken into consideration in determining whether that's relevant for something that's happening when that individual is an adult.
But my question is, in a case where you've got admissibility being the favored position under 414, shouldn't there be some obligation on the trial defense counsel to specifically point to the judge as to which things the defense wants the judge to consider when doing the 403 balancing? And if the defense doesn't do that, while that doesn't necessarily preclude our finding of error, doesn't that make it pretty hard to say that the judge has abused his discretion under a rule that basically favors admissibility when the defense hasn't even said, these are the items that I want you to balance under 403?
Well, Your Honor, perhaps the defense could have done a better job in tying together an argument what specific points the judge should have considered. But nevertheless, we would submit that the evidence was sufficiently there on the record for the judge to be aware of the different points that he should have considered. We would also submit that because he didn't even consider the particular factor regarding the presence or the absence of intervening circumstances, that this honorable court should give the judge's balancing test less deference as a result.
Very in part, it seems to me, began its analysis with a discussion of the fact that the military judge in that case had made minimal findings and, in fact, had failed to address many of the right factors. You're not suggesting that the military judge in this case had that same level of non-responsiveness with respect to the right factors, are you?
With respect to some of the right factors, yes, Your Honor.
What other than this you're arguing about the intervening circumstances did the military judge consider to did he fail to consider under right?
Well, another one of the right factors, it wasn't that he necessarily failed to consider it. We would submit that his analysis was deficient, basically regarding the danger of confusion for the members, of distraction to the members, regarding testimony from KSB being presented to the members. The military judge merely stated that KSB was the only witness that was going to be presented. He didn't provide any further analysis on that. Yet the military judge should have been fully aware, because of the evidence that was developed during the motion hearing, that it was going to go beyond KSB. And he should have been able to anticipate that. In addition to just basic testimony from KSB about what happened, that the defense was also going to be in a position where they had to try to neutralize that testimony. And there was also a testimony during the motion hearing from Dr. Youngblood about a number of relatively complex concepts dealing with things such as repressed versus suppressed memory, contaminated memory, reconstructed memory. And those were all things that came out on the record during the period the KSP was testifying, Your Honor.
Let me ask one last question, which is, please, can you give me your best argument as to why we should find that the appellant in this case was a child versus an adult from the ages of 16 to 19 years old? Because, I mean, that, to me, is the crux of this issue. So tell me why we should think that.
Yes, Your Honor. Well, there shouldn't be any, we would submit that there should not be any bright line rule as to what specific age, this type of analysis would no longer apply to, because each individual is going to have their own development that they go through. Each individual is going to have their own progression of how they're developing from a child or an adolescent into an adult. So while some, obviously some individuals may develop sooner, others individuals may develop later. It just all depends on the circumstances of that particular case. And in this, in the instant case, the evidence certainly suggested that the appellant was living in a somewhat isolated environment with his parents in a situation where he wasn't necessarily exposed to many other examples in terms of how to conduct himself, in terms of gaining other life experiences, until he later moved out of that environment, joined the Air Force, and married and developed, set up his own household.
So should we consider all people that grow up in rural, isolated environments to potentially not be adults until they've lived in the city? I mean, I'm just trying to understand where you would draw the line, because I don't see one that's clear at all.
Yes, Your Honor. Well, I guess our position is that there should not necessarily be a line drawn, that it doesn't necessarily, obviously it's not just people that grow up in rural environments, but it just all depends on, I guess, what circumstances they're living in, during those early periods of their life. Each may be different. Each individual is going to be exposed to different influences, to different examples, that have different experiences early on in their life that just may impact one individual differently than another. And that's why we would submit that there's no bright line age at which either becomes an intervening circumstance or doesn't become an intervening circumstance.
Thank you.
And as this court made clear in United States versus Berry, if a military judge is going to find that the acts of an adolescent are relevant to the acts of an adult, that there needs to be competent evidence on the record, and there needs to be a meaningful analysis by the military judge of the different phases of the appellant's life, and that's really what was missing in this case. Here there was not competent evidence to support a connection between these two periods of appellant's life, nor was there any analysis by the military judge. With respect to the distraction to the fact finder, a mini trial did develop in this case. As we mentioned in our brief, there was discussion during the opening statement about KSB coming in to testify and sitting 15 or 16 feet away from the appellant. Listen to what she's going to say when she talks about how Sergeant Barron molested her. During her testimony, aside from just going into the basic facts about what happened, they covered a number of other topics, such as how KSB realized that what Sergeant Barron was doing was wrong. Who did she talk to about it? What's her relationship with the appellant been like since then? They went into a story that she had written in high school and discussion about what precipitated that story and how it mirrored events that occurred with the appellant. Talked about gaps in her memory, the trauma of remembering, how her memory basically was changing over time.
Did defense counsel make specific objections to each of those pieces of testimony?
Not during her testimony, Your Honor, no.
Okay, so defense counsel did not object to those particular facts being elicited at trial?
Correct, Your Honor.
Just objected to her testifying at all?
Yes, Your Honor.
what do you think our standard of review would be with respect to those statements, given that there was no objection made?
Well, we would submit that this court should analyze whether the military judge abused his discretion in terms of even allowing KSB to testify at all, because it should have been clear to the military judge prior to her testifying from the motion hearing that these were all, you know, topics of discussion that were likely to come up just from her testimony during the motion hearing.
Counsel, do we have a two-part analysis here? That is, as to the whether she should have testified, there's all those matters that you've raised are reviewed under an abuse of discretion on the issue of whether she should have testified. But if we conclude that the judge didn't err in allowing her to testify, then the question of whether any of those particular items should have been asked or answered would be reviewed under a plain error standard. Would that be your view?
Yes, Your Honor, in light of no objection from the defense counsel. And then the final point to make with respect to the distracting mini-trial that developed in this case, it's interesting to note that during findings argument, the first argument that the trial counsel opened up with was reference to KSB's testimony. He specifically began his findings argument by telling the court members that the appellant has basically been molesting his entire adult life, and you heard the testimony from KSB, and certainly the implication was that the appellant was basically, you know, to the core, a child molester at heart who really had was basically doing that his entire adult life. If there are no additional questions with respect to 414, I'd like to touch on the 404B aspect of it briefly.
Counsel, if we proceed on the assumption that the 404B was error without deciding that it's error, does that affect the 414 analysis? In other words, do we need to reach the 404B issue in this case if we decide, and you're not conceding this, that the 414 admissibility was permissible?
Your Honor, if this court would determine that there was admissible under 414, I don't believe that the 404B aspect would be a player in the case. As far as the 404B goes, really the key aspect there is the McDonald case, and we would just submit that for the similar reasons that were outlined in McDonald, the evidence in this case was also inadmissible under 404B. It did not constitute a common plan or scheme. It was also not relevant with regards to appellant's intent, based on the fact that there was no evidence connecting the states of mind during the two different periods, and as well there were enough differences in the circumstances that it did not constitute a common plan. With respect to the prejudice aspect of this case, the admission of KSB's testimony materially prejudiced the appellant's case, and the key to look at here is that the case largely hinged on the testimony of RMB. RMB's testimony was of a fluctuating nature over numerous interviews conducted leading up to trial. She also stated during her testimony at the court-martial that, for example, on page 557 of the record, she states that she frequently gets confused about what happened in this case and when. And one of the key aspects of this case was whether or not the evidence fell outside the statute of limitations period. That was one of the big contested issues in this case, and the defense essentially set up a temporal marker, which was an incident where his spouse had caught him in a bedroom with TLA, and it was established through the evidence that essentially anything that came before that watershed event fell outside of the statute of limitations period. And the evidence significantly indicated that the vast majority of events in this case came before that point. Now, R&B did testify that she thought that there were perhaps two or three incidents that occurred after that, but she was not at all clear from her testimony as to whether or not that any of those incidents involved sodomy. The members apparently had concerns as well. One of the members asked her the question, that you mentioned an incident at work. What happened there? And R&B's testimony was that she could not remember anything about that incident. Additionally, I see my time's about to end. I'll briefly conclude, Your Honor.
Briefly conclude, and then you'll have an opportunity during rebuttal to determine whether you want to address 414 or 404.
Yes, Your Honor. For the reasons outlined, that the military judge did abuse his discretion in admitting the evidence under both 414 and 404B, and as a result, we would ask that this honorable court set aside the contested findings on the sentence in this case.
Thank you. We'll now hear from the government.
May it please the court, Chief Judge Efron, honorable members of the court. My name is Captain Jefferson E. McBride, and together with Colonel Gerald R. Bush, who represents the United States government in this matter. The military judge did not err when he admitted the uncharged molestation of KSB, that is the appellant's sister, under 414, even in light of the fact that this prior molestation occurred 8 years prior to the charged time frame. The only thing I err, he certainly did not abuse his discretion in admitting the evidence.
Are you in agreement with the appellant as to the date facts here? That the appellant was age 15 or 16 at the time of the 414 acts and that they continued until he was age 19?
Yes, Your Honor.
And that he was at age 28 when the charged acts occurred?
Yes, Your Honor.
And 34 at the time of trial? Not a trick question, I'm just trying to get the timeline.
I'm thinking 32, but 34 I think probably is.
Because obviously one of the issues here is in as to whether Barry is distinguished or not, and in what way, if at all, is whether this appellant should be treated as an adult in some manner at the age of 19 or sometime there before or after. So age is important. That's a comment, not a question.
It is. I was thinking, as you went through, that it was 32 at the time of trial, but 90... 8 was the alleged charge time frame, so I think you are correct, Your Honor.
Does age at the time of trial have any bearing, other than giving us an overall perspective on the case in terms of the particular issue before us? What are the critical ages?
It's the government's position that the time of trial age has no bearing. It's the times between what was the last uncharged misconduct, what was the age then, and what was the beginning time frame when he began to molest the child, when you're considering the charge time frame. Specifically in this case, though, in light of the fact there was evidence of uncharged acts of the victim, obviously that they charged, we believe that's the date of his age when he first began to molest his biological daughter, which is where the government comes up with the 8 years, I believe, between when he was 19 and ultimately when he was 26, 27, when he began the molestation of...
Just out of curiosity, why do you get to start with the oldest that he was for the uncharged acts and the youngest that he was for the charged acts? I'm just curious. Other than it gives you the shortest period of time between the two.
Well, obviously, I think in the context of analyzing, was this can you relate intent from one act to another act that is to some degree well removed, whether it's, you know, 8 years or 12 years? But it's important to note that this wasn't a time where it was just one single incident. You have a bunch of incidents occurring when he's 18 or 19, and so those years become particularly relevant. That's why we focus on 18 and 19 as opposed to the 15-year, 16, 17-year-old time frame. So we use that, I think, as a critical factor, because he's molesting his sister pervasively as much then as he did before. And so you can relate that intent to when he started pervasively molesting his daughter at when he's 26 or 27. And so for purposes of judging the totality of the circumstances into account and determining, can you legitimately take this person's state of mind at the time that he's 18 or 19 and relate them to when he's 26 or 28, whichever one is really a critical factor. As Judge Urban, I believe, pointed out in the Berry case, he talks about the difference between the formative years from 15 to, I believe, 17 was what you want to put down. And that's why, again, 18 and 19 is important here, because it not only falls outside the time frame that Judge Urban was talking about, where you can't relate intent to some years later, the intervening circumstance that he talks about in that case. Again, the 18 and 19-year-old time frame is more important than the beginning, although the government suggests that you can see that he's 18 and 19, he's an adult, that intent is the same as when he was 15. The suggestion then that it was something that he learned from his dad and that that's how he showed his love becomes less credible as you advance into the adult years, which I think the Berry case was concerned with.
I mean, even if when he was 26 or 28, that's what he thought, I mean, does that change the nature of his offense? I mean, even if he molested his daughter because he thought that that's how you showed love, is that a defense? Or is it mitigation?
Well, no, it's not a defense. I guess it is more setting up the mitigation for in sentencing. But that did, I guess, come out in findings, that kind of issue. And I think the defense was trying to work that to their benefit, whatever they could. But I think it is more relevant towards mitigation as opposed to any defense, affirmative or otherwise.
What do you make of appellant's argument that in determining whether someone has, I guess, ended their formative years and become an adult, that's a person-by-person analysis into the particular circumstances, apparently, that they're living in and grown up under?
I think he was speaking that there should be no bright line rule. And to some degree, the government agrees with that. But here's the problem with that, is that this court should look at 18 years old as that mark in the face of something else. For example, if the defense raises the issue of this guy's 18 and 19 now, but look at his mental capacity, he's less mature than the average person, it should be the defense's burden at that point to show. 18 and 19 then is not of the adult age that we're looking at when we're comparing apples to apples with regards to intent from a prior molestation that occurred earlier. So that's the government's contention, is that in the face of something else, 18 and 19 should be determined, this court should determine, this is presumption that he's an adult and he's acting in the same capacity that he does some years later, especially in this case when it's a mere 8 years later.
Is intent the same thing as propensity?
I guess when I'm arguing, I guess I'm using it for the same, I'm interrelated, but I'm not sure. I think they can be different. I think propensity is a... I think they can be the same.
My question is, for purposes of the 403 balancing test, is the issue on the balancing of unfair prejudice, confusion, misleading, undue delay, waste of time, needless presentation, is that measured against intent, or is it measured against propensity? So that the question of whether someone at 18, something about what they did at 18 is pertinent to what they did at 28 or 38 or 48, whatever the age might be in a particular charge, does the judge look at that in terms of the underlying question of propensity? What bearing does the conduct at age 18 or 16 or 14, whatever we have, bear on propensity as opposed to intent?
Well, I guess first I'm trying to separate out the two.
Right. I mean, my understanding of the purpose of 414 is that propensity is a less rigorous requirement in terms of proof than intent. If it weren't, then there really wouldn't be any need for 414, would there? You'd go under 404.
That is true, Your Honor. I guess when I think of the two, you're thinking of propensity to commit the act, the charged act, and to some degree that always involves intent in that regard. Although I believe at least the government's contention is that it doesn't always have to show that. Propensity can just be you take this evidence to show that he could have committed this charged conduct, whether you want to relate it to, well, it kind of shows his intent or so forth and so on. And the relaxed standard is the extension of the 404B, so I think they kind of flow in together, and it's Congress that has kind of just extended 404B and those reasons for admission into the propensity element, I guess, for lack of a better term.
My understanding of 414, and I certainly stand to be corrected on this, is that with 414, you're not looking at intent. That is, you're not looking at whether the individual has consciously formed an intention to do a particular act. It's the doing of the act that's pertinent to the later question of whether it was repeated.
I agree, Your Honor, but I guess I was just trying to point out that I think the fact finders can use that propensity information not just for purposes of he did it there, so now he must have done it this time, but I think they could look at the propensity evidence in a way to show, well, he has this propensity that shows me he had the intent. The government gets the distinction that Your Honor was making, and I agree with that distinction. I think that they can also be the same.
So to wrap up then, when the judge, do you agree, and I'm trying to figure out whether I agree with this, that when the judge does the 403 balancing, the context in which the judge is doing that is, how does the balance weigh on the question of whether this is propensity evidence as opposed to whether it's intent evidence? That is, propensity evidence is supposed to be coming in, then do the 403 balancing to say whether there are factors to keep propensity out.
I agree, Your Honor. In this case, I think the military judge went into that portion he talked about in intent for purposes of his 403 balancing, but I agree that that's generally what you're balancing, and that's why it's important to determine are the acts similar or not for purposes of propensity, because certainly it's hard to say you have a propensity to do one thing when it's a different act or so dissimilar that you can't show propensity or intent or however else you won't approve that act.
Regarding the 403 balancing test, does your position hinge on whether it is applied with the thumb on one side or the other, or as it is applied in other contexts?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, could you...
Does your position in this case hinge on whether we apply the 403 balancing test with the thumb weighted in one manner or another? Both parties have thrown around Guardia and Compte for different propositions. Are you asking this court to lean when we apply the 403 balancing test because it's 414? Or are you saying, no, no, apply the same old balancing test you always apply?
No, Your Honor, it's the government's contention, and we tried to outline this in the brief. Is the government believes that...
You did. I'm trying to clarify, just making sure.
It's the government's contention that there should be... the balancing test should be obviously weighed towards admissibility, and therefore...
So you are asking for a weighted balancing test?
Yes, Your Honor. We're asking that this court use a less onerous, if you will, standard 403 balancing than in under 414 than you would...
And that's how you read LeCompte.
Yes, Your Honor.
So you would say, don't go with Guardia.
Yes, Your Honor.
Go with our reading of LeCompte.
Yes, Your Honor.
Is that necessary to your case? Would you lose if that weren't the case?
I don't think so, Your Honor.
Then why are you pushing for that?
Well, it was important to, I think, in the big picture of things, to settle this particular standard, because in light of the fact that defense brings up, they think the standard should be very onerous under...
Did the judge in this case rely on a weighted 403 balancing test?
No, Your Honor. From the best you could tell on his findings of fact, and as they progressed through the motion hearing, it appeared that he was doing a 403 balancing test, as you would say, under 404, only highlighting the laundry list of factors enumerated in Wright. So I don't think he did. I'm being generous to the government in doing this particular 403 analysis.
Why would we want to reach out and decide something that we don't have to decide in this case? I mean, if your argument doesn't depend on it, why would you want us to decide it here?
Well, I guess it's not important for this particular case, but perhaps with... dicta or other information provided in any opinion, that it would be helpful in the future, regardless of whether it impacts this case for future litigation in this area.
Let me ask you another question. Assuming that the court disagreed with you and thought that there was error in this case, do you believe that the court has enough information before it to make a prejudice determination, or is that something that would be remanded to the CCA?
I think this court has enough, and I guess I point to Durell, which talked about performing a exhaustive balancing test, and then that he gave an instruction in the end. In Durell, that seemed to indicate, in the face of the military judge's careful consideration in the instruction, and like that there is an acquittal here, there is a specification here where he gets an acquittal, that in that case the court considered, well, we think that they followed the law regardless. They weren't inflamed, they weren't overly persuaded, and so we're not going to find prejudice in that case. Additionally, what you have here, though, is information of TA, the stepdaughter, that was never contested, that was never objected to. They conceded that it was relevant, and needed to go before the members. You also had the information of the prior uncharged acts of his biological daughter that fell outside the charge time frame that also came in. So all that information that came in, I think, shows that there would not have been in this court standard, substantially different outcome in the end. Admittedly, the government's case depended on the key witness here, the daughter, but there was, as I think trial counsel highlighted in his argument, that that information was corroborated to some extent by the other witnesses, and ultimately the appellant's confession in this case, or admissions to at least prior acts.
Which sort of begs a question, this is really a rhetorical question, which is, you know, why did the government, you know, put on the evidence with respect to KSB at all? I mean, your argument is they didn't need it, and I would tend to agree with you, so why go there?
Well, I think in the record, Judge Sigmund said it best, is that typically the government does go with the kitchen sink attitude when you're going in and litigating. In the future, would you like to see trial counsel be more careful about what they really need? Certainly, that goes with, you know, in voir dire, whether they're objecting for cause or that kind of thing. We see that all the time. But I think the law is pretty clear that just because they didn't need it doesn't mean they shouldn't be allowed to put it on in the end, and that we're looking at prejudice, taking that into account.
To turn back briefly to the 403 balancing test question, and I'm not asking you to testify here. One of the factors that a court may take into account in deciding how broadly or narrowly to write an opinion is the frequency with which an issue is litigated based on published decisions that things we can take judicial notice of. What's the government's view as to whether the question of whether this judge applied the proper test or whether a different test should be used for balancing under 413 or 414, to what extent is that a recurring issue which the government believes should be addressed, or is it a matter which is so infrequent that we should wait for further developments?
Are you specifically referring, sir, to the...
To the question of whether 403 balancing is considered under a particular standard in the context of 413 or 414, whether it applies the same standard under considering 404, or whether that should simply be allowed for future to await future developments.
Well, the government suggests that this honorable court should get started right away in trying to parse out what is the standard, whether, like I said before, whether it is, well, we don't need to decide this issue for purposes of, you know, telling everyone where we're going with this. This is how we analyze. This is the standard we use under 403.
I understand the government's asking for that, but is that based upon the frequency with which this matter is litigated and the importance of giving guidance in the context of frequency, or is it based on a concept that although infrequent, it's important? What's the basis for the government's suggestion that this court decide that particular issue?
Well, like anything else, issues seem to go in business cycles, and recently there seems to be an upturn in this kind of issue. And in light of the fact there's always confusion between 404 and the 414, and usually one, they argue one and the other, and there's even a problem there where you're saying, well, if there's 414, you're allowing the 404B. So I guess it's the frequency in which the government perceives this as been coming up, and perception that it's going to come up is it's like child pornography as it starts to spread through the circuits that it's going to come up more. So in order to avoid this kind of situation in the future, to show the military judges what kind of standard they need to be using for this, for CAF to approve what they're doing is important. That, based on just the importance of the issue and the frequency which the government perceives will happen in the future.
Does that mean that this court got the law wrong and right in Barry? In which this court applied a 403 balancing test, but without weighting it. So you're in essence saying that the government, I mean, this court had the law wrong in Wright and Berry.
Well, I guess I'm not sure I read Wright and Berry to this as we're not weighting one or the other, because in, if I'm not mistaken, in Wright, LeConte is cited right after the stream site, right after Gordia.
So in your view, this court in Wright was adopting a weighted 403 balancing test, not by saying it expressly, but by citing a case which requires you to interpret that case in a manner that the government's interpreting it today?
Well,
that's the correct reading of Wright?
Well, I think it's... I think it's confusing when you read Gordia, and it seems to say you're doing a 404D balancing, and then you read LeComte that's strung right after it, and it says something different. That's why I'm not sure I read Barry and Wright to say that that this court has actually adopted one thing or another. It's just kind of done an analysis.
Okay, thank you.
If I could just address one thing on the 414 that counsel addressed, they suggested that temporal proximity and intervening circumstances weren't addressed by a military judge, but it's the government's position that they did address adequately the temporal proximity and looked at the ages between the uncharged act and the charged act, and that's in his findings of fact, paragraph 7 to paragraph 9, I believe that in the totality of it, you can see that he was taking those into consideration. Additionally, Durell is clear in suggesting that a full-blown, going through all the exhaustive, the list suggested in Wright is not necessary, just as long as it appears that the judge has carefully reviewed all the information and done a balancing between the probative and prejudicial value of the evidence. In light of the fact that the government is relying on 414, government believes this court does not need to address 404B, and any error in 404B doesn't impact the 414 analysis in any event. So unless there are any questions with regard to the 404B issue, that concludes my argument. The government, if I could conclude real quickly, the government respectfully asked this court to affirm the finding of the sentence in this case.
Thank you, counsel. Does the defense have rebuttal?
We would take issue with the government's argument that because the appellant turned 18 years old during the time frame where he was allegedly molesting KSB, that somehow takes this case outside of the Barry arena. Just examining human nature would certainly indicate that if this starts when an individual is 15 or 16 years old, and there are no intervening circumstances between them being 16 years old and turning 18 years old, they don't just suddenly wake up in the morning on the day of their 18th birthday and come to the realization that what they're doing is wrong, or whatever else the case may be. It's not until those intervening circumstances take place and they're able to take themselves out of that environment that obviously they undergo that growth period and that transition period that this court highlighted is so important to take a look at in the Barrett case. And that's why we would submit that it's important not to have any kind of a bright line rule with respect to a particular age that an individual is at.
Let me ask you a question, counsel. Let's change the facts just slightly and say that in this case, the appellant at the age of 17 years and 11 months with parental agreement joined the Air Force and came back home on leave when he was 18 years and 2 months. Is there any question in your mind that he could be criminally charged for the acts regarding KSP at that point in time? Or are you arguing that he would have some sort of defense of lack of mental responsibility because he hadn't had time to realize that what he was doing was wrong?
We're not arguing that that would be a defense to a charge against regarding if he was charged with molesting KSB. That's our position. We're not putting forth the argument that this would be a defense.
And how does the fact that he didn't know what he might not have known what he was doing when he was wrong at the age of 18 and 19 years old because he hadn't left home, how does that help you?
The reason that it's important to the defense's case, Your Honor, the reason that it's important for appellants is that I think Barry makes clear it's important that you take a look at who the appellant was at the time of the charged offenses and who he was during the period of the uncharged misconduct, particularly when you have this significant intervening period where a number of important circumstances take place.
Ultimately, this goes to the questions I ask in government. Isn't the question there then whether he no longer has the propensity? 414 comes in for propensity. So anything that has to deal with age, time, gaps, change, doesn't that all get then assessed as to whether the propensity is no longer there?
Yes, I mean, we would agree that 414 obviously is dealing with propensity as opposed to intent under 404B. Now, here again, in comparing this case with Barry, the same deficiencies occurred in that the military judge, while we agree that he looked in his 403 balancing test, he did consider the length of time that transpired between KSB and RMB. The key factor that was absent from his analysis was comparing an appellant as an adult versus an adolescent. And just briefly, with respect to the prejudice aspect in this case, the reason that the introduction of KSB's testimony was markedly different from also having TLA's testimony in this case, was because the evidence regarding TLA essentially happened concurrently with RMB. By introducing KSB into the equation, the members at that point are able to go back to an early point in the appellant's life and draw a line from there all the way to the present charge time frame and conclude that the appellant had essentially done nothing in his entire lifetime except essentially, you know, continuously engage in acts of molestation. And based on that prejudice and because of the military judge's abuse of discretion, we would ask that this court set aside the contested findings.
Thank you, counsel, and we thank counsel for both parties for your argument today. The court will stand in recess until 5 minutes after 10 o'clock this morning. The court will now hear United States against Tippett. Is the defense ready to proceed?
May it please the court. Good morning. Chief Judge Efron, honorable members of the court, I'm Captain Vicki Pelou, and together with Lieutenant Colonel Mark Strickland, represent the appellant in this case, Staff Sergeant Robert D. Tippett. I intend to argue the issues you've granted in order. The road to arraignment for Reservist Staff Sergeant Tippett was long and filled with blunders by the government. Unfortunately, Staff Sergeant Tippett had to not only suffer the punishment he endured during the pretrial restraint, but also the punishment he had to endure from the government's blunders while waiting for his court-martial and not being allowed to return to his civilian life.
Counsel, before we get going, can you tell us when Tippett was in pretrial restraint?
He was in pretrial restraint from June 15, 2001 to 1 August 2001, based on the military judge's findings within the court-martial. The military judge, the defense filed a motion to dismiss for lack of jurisdiction and denial of appellant's right to a speedy trial under the rule for courts martial 707. Staff Sergeant Tippett was arraigned on 21 November 2002 eventually. The military judge denied the motion, finding that the withdrawal was a de facto dismissal and was done for a legitimate reason. On 6 September 2001, charges were preferred against Staff Sergeant Tippett, and on 10 September 2001, those charges were withdrawn by trial counsel Captain D. There's no evidence within the record that the convening authority was aware of the 6 September 2001 charges being withdrawn. On 10 September 2001...
Is that an issue in this case?
The defense did not raise the issue of the, did not contest the 6 September 2001 charges. However, that is when the speedy trial clock actually started ticking, because those charges, although they were withdrawn by Captain D, their disposition of those charges never really occurred.
Can a charge be withdrawn if it hasn't been referred to a court-martial? I mean, the withdrawal is talking about being withdrawn from the court-martial, right?
Correct.
And a case isn't at a court-martial until it's been referred by a convening authority to a particular panel, right?
Correct.
So how could the charges in this case, the ones in 2000, have been withdrawn when they had not been referred?
That's the actual issue in the case. They have not been withdrawn because it's, as a matter of law, it's impossible to withdraw charges that have never been referred.
And so why? So you're agreeing that they were not withdrawn?
Correct.
Because they could not be?
Correct.
And hasn't this court acknowledged that in such cases we look at a de facto dismissal analysis?
There is case law where it's been looked at as a de facto dismissal in some circumstances.
Well, you're not disagreeing that the appellant in this case was told that the charges were dropped, right?
Correct.
And he was allowed to go home?
Yes, Your Honor.
And when he came back, that the charges were re-preferred, reinvestigated, and then referred to a court-martial?
Correct. However, the intent, there was no legitimate reason for these charges to be dismissed, as the intent shows that these charges were going to be re-preferred. Although appellant was told that the charges were dropped, he was never informed why the charges were dropped, and he was allowed to return home under the impression that these charges had gone away. Clearly, based on from his testimony at court, he thought the case was over, while the government this whole entire time not informing the appellant as to why.
Is that your argument? That you win because the appellant was not told?
That it goes towards the prejudice against the appellant, because the government's perfecting their case during the time frame that they already know they're continuing with these cases, that the appellant is still facing charges. It goes to show that it was not a legitimate reason and not a de facto dismissal.
With respect to the September 6th and September 10th charges, whatever occurred on 21 November, or is it 6 November?
6 November 2001 is when they had the convening authority withdrawn.
Whatever happened on 6 November, are you arguing that it only happened with respect to the September 10 charges and not the September 6, whatever they were?
Correct, Your Honor. That it only was in regards to the 10 September 2001 charges and the 10 October 2001.
Is it your position that there is no way they could dispose of the September 6 charges? The government's just tough out of luck. If they got the September 6th charges wrong, that's the end of the game? What should they have done on September 6th that they didn't do?
They did not, the September 6th charges
If they can't withdraw because there's no court martial yet, what were they supposed to do if they wanted to do something different on September 10th?
If they wanted to essentially dismiss the 6 September 2001 charges, they still had to go through the convening authority, and there's no evidence within the record that the convening authority was aware and approved any dismissal, withdrawal of any charges.
Where does it say that? Where does it say that the convening authority is involved at the preferral stage? I mean, isn't the preferral done by an accuser?
Correct, Your Honor.
And in fact, if the convening authority—I mean—is the convening authority even supposed to be involved at that point in time, or must they be involved at that time? Because I mean, it sounds like what you're saying is what they did wrong on September 6th was they didn't get the convening authority's approval, and I question whether they need to.
They need to get the special court martial jurisdiction, convening authority exercising special court martial jurisdiction to dismiss any charges, and that's based under RCM 404, action by commander when receipt of charges. That's an action that he'd have to take.
Now, I just want to make clear here as to what's before us. It seems that your argument is the September 6th charge, since there's nothing in the record to indicate any action by a commander or a convening authority, whatever that may be, that those charges were dismissed, that the speedy trial clock on those charges continued to tick.
Correct.
Okay. And I thought from reading the case that that was an issue that had not been litigated or contested here.
It was an issue that had not been litigated or contested. However, under our ineffective assistance of counsel, it's raised that the counsel should have addressed that issue.
So, but it's not raised in regard to your first argument, which is the speedy trial argument. What you're talking about there is the speedy trial clock continued to run from the September 10th charges. Is that correct?
To some extent, it's correct. The defense during the trial, they didn't state whether they basically just said it was something that didn't affect the speedy trial because it really was only four extra days that would have been taken into consideration. So the focus really mainly is on the 10 September 2001 charges because there's more evidence to support that it's not a dismissal, it was not done, it's not a de facto dismissal, and was not done for a legitimate reason and not done in accordance with RCM 401C1 and also United States versus Britain.
And when a question arises in a case like this as to whether or not there's been a withdrawal or de facto dismissal or dismissal, who is the burden on to establish what action the government had taken?
It's on the government, Your Honor.
Counsel, for purposes of disposing of those charges, as opposed to the September 10th charges, as opposed to the question of, for purposes of deciding whether the charges were properly dismissed for under the speedy trial rule, but just in terms of dismissal, what was wrong with the action taken by the convening authority in lining out those charges? Why weren't those charges at that point dismissed? And that question in my mind is different from the question, but correct me if I'm wrong, of whether that dismissal was sufficient for purposes of the speedy trial rule. You're intermixing your arguments there, and I want to try to separate them out.
I'm not quite sure if I understand the question.
Were the charges dismissed when the convening authority lined them out? I understand your argument that that dismissal was inappropriate for purposes of stopping the speedy trial clock, but for purposes of actually determining whether those charges were dismissed, why wasn't the convening authorities lining them out sufficient?
They were not dismissed because the convening authority, based on the legal office's memorandum, it's clear that the appellant still faced those charges, although they stated within the memorandum that you can re-prefer these charges 3 months down the road when an investigation is complete. But these same charges, essentially in the end, when the charges were re-preferred, were the essential same charges that he faced at that time.
That, again, I think that goes to your question as to whether that was a sufficient act for stopping the speedy trial clock. I'm just trying to look first at the issue of whether the convening authority had the power and could line out those charges and thereby dismiss them at that point. Why isn't that just for purposes of Rule 401, not for purposes of Rule 707, but for 401, why isn't the convening authority's action? With due respect to the JAG Corps, my understanding is that it is not the JAG Corps that runs the military justice system, it's the convening authority.
Yes, Your Honor. Why it's not, yes, the convening authority under 404 and 401 can dismiss charges. However, in this case, under 401C1, under the discussion, it states the charge should be dismissed when it fails to state an offense, when it's unsupported by available evidence, or when there are other sound reasons why a trial by court-martial is not appropriate. And then the discussion also goes on to state that also if the charges do not adequately reflect the nature of the seriousness of the offense.
Can't a convening authority dismiss charges for any reason he or she wants to? If this convening authority, let's put aside racial prejudice, etc., if this convening authority said, I just don't want to go forward with this case, why couldn't the convening authority line out the charges and that be the end of it?
The convening authority could do that if that was exactly what the convening authority was going to do.
All we have here is the convening authority is lining it out. Do we have anything that says what was in the convening authority's mind when he did this?
Based on the memorandum to the convening authority from the office, it stated that within that memorandum, it stated that there was an ongoing joint investigation between federal investigators and the Office of Special Investigation. That was in the memorandum to the convening authority. However, the OSI in their media analysis, which was done, their media analysis request, which was done on 31 October 2001, and the memorandum for the convening authority was done on 2 November 2001. In the OSI's media analysis, it stated that the legal office needed to drop the charges and refile in order to get appellant back on.
Did the convening authority have that?
There's no evidence whether the convening authority
Right. So why don't we just proceed on the basis that the convening authority dismissed these charges and then go to your argument under 707 as to whether that dismissal knocked out the clock or not?
Because as a matter of law, he cannot withdraw charges, and based on the memorandum that was forwarded up to the convening authority, the entire memorandum was stated withdraw charges, and within that, they continuously stated withdraw, and the convening authority concurred with this.
Well, let me ask you a question. If the convening authority had dismissed the charges, would you agree that you don't have a 707 issue?
If the convening authority had
just take my hypothetical that the convening authority dismissed the charges, would you have a 707 argument?
Yes, Your Honor, we would.
How?
Because based on Rule 401 in the discussion, it was not a legitimate dismissal of the charges. If the convening authority had actually lined through and it was stated dismissal, it still would not have been a legitimate dismissal based under the discussion of 401C1.
And why is that?
Because This was not done for any of the reasons under 401c1. The charges did not fail to state an offense. They weren't unsupported by available evidence. And based on, clearly based on the Article 32 investigation from the first Article 32 that was done, and then from the second Article 32 that was done, within that second Article 32, the IO specifically stated that the evidence from the first Article 32 was what she was using.
I was just going to say, what do you do about the fact that 401c1 specifically contemplates that a commander dismisses charges and that further disposition isn't barred by referring you back to RCM 306C? I mean, you seem to be suggesting that the commander can't dismiss charges, that investigation continues, which the military judge specifically found in this case that it did, and which it appears that, in fact, the final AFOSI report was released on 6-28-02, and then reinvestigate, and refer charges to a court-martial. And I just don't know where you're getting that from.
Based on United States versus Britain, where it states that there are substantial differences between withdrawal and dismissal of charges, but specifically the court explained that dismissal contemplates that the accused no longer faces charges, that conditions of liberty on liberty and pretrial restraint are lifted, and that he's returned to full-time duty with rights, full rights as accorded to all other service members. Reinstitution of charges requires the command to start over. The charges must be re-preferred, investigated, and referred in accordance with the rules for court-martial.
That's what happened here. They were re-preferred. There was another Article 32 investigation. They were referred. And so, I mean, I understand the argument you're trying to make, but I'm not sure what you're relying on.
It was not reinvestigated. They just used the same investigation from the article. It
was a new Article 32 investigating officer appointed?
Correct. Yes,
and there was an Article 32 investigation,
yes,
right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And the appellant sought to waive the Article 32 investigation, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
But it was conducted anyway.
Yes, Your Honor.
And you would agree that people are allowed in an Article 32 investigation to rely on statements, whether they were made in an Article 32 investigation or otherwise?
Yes, Your Honor. However, this goes to show, specifically based on what the investigating officer stated, it goes to show that the charges were not, and the whole process was not started new. It just basically continued on from the original preferral of the charges. The investigating officer in footnote 1 on page 3 of her report states substantially when she says the IO, talking about the Article 32 IO from the first investigation, that I found that the evidence presented at the initial Article 32 hearing supported a referral of charges. And in her footnote, she states, substantially the same evidence introduced at Article 32 hearing held on 5 and 6 August.
But doesn't that go to the adequacy of the 32? That is, the defense at that point is every right to complain that there was not an adequate Article 32 investigation, which then is litigated before the judge. In the absence of that litigation, what difference does it make what the Article 32 officer relied on, whether it was a prior Article 32, whether it was matters that were in other documents in which there were depositions, etc.? If there's no objection, what pertinence does that have?
Well, it goes to show that these charges it was not started anew. It's evidence of that. Now, granted, also within our ineffective assistance of counsel argument, the defense counsel should have objected, and they should have raised several objections to the fact of this Article 32 and what occurred within it. Also within United States versus Britain.
Where in 401 does it say that the convening authority can only dismiss charges for those reasons that are listed in the discussion, either in the rule or in the discussion itself? Where does it say that the convening authority can't dismiss charges for any reason that convening authority thinks appropriate, including, I like this airman, I like this officer, I don't want him or her to go to trial? Where does it say that a convening authority can't do that?
Within 401, respectfully, it doesn't say that the community...
Isn't that a traditional power of the convening authority, and one of the reasons why we have convening authorities in the military justice system, that no matter how much a staff judge advocate or a prosecutor wants to bring a case to trial, that the convening authority can say, no, I want this person in my unit, I don't want him to go to trial?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
And isn't the normal law with respect to an improper dismissal for purposes of speedy trial that there's some evidence that they were on the eve of trial and they had a speedy trial problem, so they thought what we'll do is we'll dismiss the charges so that we don't have a speedy trial problem?
Yes.
And what evidence do you have that that was what was going on here, that's in the record?
Well, what's unique and different between that case law that supports that and this case in particular is the fact that Staff Sergeant Tippett was a reservist. So they could let him go back to his civilian life and then bring him back on the orders.
But how does it answer my question as to what evidence do you have in this case that the reason that the convening authority dismissed the charges against your client was because they had a speedy trial problem at that point in time and needed to do it for some ulterior motive that was improper?
Based on
the case law?
Based on the case law is normally like within 5 days of the charges being dismissed and then re-preferred. However, in this case, it's unique because of the fact that the community authority was advised by the SJA that they needed to do further investigation, that there was a joint investigation, which according to the OSI during the speedy trial testimony, that there was no joint investigation.
But they did agree that the AFOSI, FBI, and ATF were sharing information regarding interrelated investigations that touched on the appellant.
Correct.
And that was at finding of fact number 32, and you're not suggesting that finding of fact was clearly erroneous, are you?
No, Your Honor, I'm not.
Is that an improper reason to dismiss?
To dismiss if there's an investigation going on?
Right.
One of the reasons would be to dismiss to show the seriousness of the offenses. Because the investigation was...
Focus on the question. Is it improper to dismiss if there's an ongoing investigation and the convening authority wants to see where the investigation goes?
Based on the discussion of 401C, I would say that it's improper to dismiss when an investigation is not going to show the suit where they're not...
How do you know until you can conclude the investigation?
Well, based on the OSI's testimony, they stated that the information that the joint investigation was working with, that they weren't looking for any of that information.
Does the record reflect whether the SJA was aware of something perhaps that OSI might not be aware of?
No, Your Honor.
Does it reflect that OSI knew everything that the convening authority knew?
No, Your Honor.
Okay. With respect to the withdrawal dismissal issue, are you contesting whether there's a concept of de facto dismissal or that this could be a case of dismissal? Or are you saying, well, no, I accept that. This just isn't that.
Except.
Are you arguing law or are you arguing fact?
Both, Your Honor.
So is it your position that there's no such thing as de facto dismissal?
No, Your Honor. Based on the case law, it's stated that there is possibilities for de facto.
So you accept that premise. So this is not a question of law for you. You just don't think that this convening authority did that.
Correct, Your Honor.
I'm just trying to focus on whether we have a legal issue here or a law applied to fact issue.
Our argument is that there was no de facto dismissal in this case.
I get it. And your second argument is that if there was, the reason was not legitimate?
Yes, Your Honor.
Or, period. And it was not legitimate because?
Because the reason why they wanted to dismiss was not based on the reason that the evidence supports, one, that there was no joint investigation that was going on, a formal joint investigation.
But that's a game of wordsmithing. You're focusing on whether it's a joint investigation or not.
But, and also within the OSI's testimony in the speedy trial, they stated that they were asked, so I'm asking you, can you point to me any document right now that existed on 2 November 2001 that shows that you were in fact looking or investigating more serious crimes? The answer from OSI agent, Special Agent Mallory, was no. Their ongoing investigation was not to...
That's OSI's investigation or the FBI's investigation?
That's OSI's investigation, and that's in the record on page 163.
Does the record reflect, in your view, whether the government was aware prior to September 6th or September 10th that the FBI and ATF were conducting an investigation that might have the appellant in as a subject or target?
The record, basically, between the OSI agent's testimony, they stated that they were working with the FBI and ATF when they were asking them questions because they were more knowledgeable, and that the one of the agencies was actually investigating another individual that they thought may have had some sort of tie.
But does the record reflect at what date OSI or the SJ is aware of that, be it before or after September 10?
I believe it was before, and
I know you're out of time, so do you want to try and hit that on rebuttal?
Yes,
if you could? Thank you. And here I'm not looking, I understand your argument, but I'm looking for where in the record would we confirm one way or the other?
My name is Captain Donna Rappel, and I, along with Gerald R. Bruce, represent the United States in this matter. There are four issues that have been granted, and they're all interrelated. I will begin with issue one. The first issue is whether the military judge erred in finding there was a de facto dismissal for a legitimate reason.
Counsel, what is the support for de facto dismissals?
Well, Your Honor, under United States v. Britain, this court clarified that dismissal contemplates that the accused no longer faces charges, that conditions on liberty and pretrial restraint are lifted, which is what happened in this case when appellant was sent home, and that he is returned to full-time duty with full rights as accorded to all other service members.
But did Britain say, talk about a de facto dismissal and recognize that as a concept?
No, Your Honor, it did not.
Okay, what other cases did? Are there any other cases from this court that have recognized the concept of de facto dismissal?
Let me have one moment. No, Your Honor. I believe that that concept came from Air Force cases, actually.
Well, I think the only one I could find was Lorick, the Navy Marine Corps case. But I want to move on. Is the intent of the convening authority important in determining whether or not charges were dismissed?
The absent showing of some improper intent, such as racial motivation or an otherwise unconstitutional reason, that no, the intent is not relevant in such that...
Can I just clarify, was the question directed to intent as to whether you're withdrawing or dismissing,
yes,
or intent as to reason you're doing whatever it is you're doing?
The not as to why. The question was, is the intent of the convening authority important in a dismissal, and that is whether or not he intends a dismissal or he intends something else?
No, Your Honor, if I understand the question correctly, at the point, it's based on the point and where the charges were. A dismissal is the only option before charges are referred. Once charges are referred, then you have a withdrawal, and that's under RCM 604. But prior to a proper referral to court-martial, the only option the commuting authority has is a dismissal.
So in this case, where the staff judge advocate recommended in writing to the convening authority that the charges be withdrawn. The convening authority concurs with that. The staff judge advocate lines out the charges and writes withdrawn. It is the government's argument that the convening authority intended that to be a dismissal.
Yes, Your Honor.
And where do you get that?
Well, based on the letter...
The documents, is it your argument the documents show that?
Well, yes, actually. The government would argue that the letter that the SJA wrote to the convening authority, although inartfully and incorrectly stated withdrawn, throughout the letter, he did correctly state the RCM 404 and the correct language under RCM 404, which only allows for dismissal.
He correctly gave the options to the convening authority, but he did not make that recommendation.
No, Your Honor. Based on the fact of the word withdrawn used in the recommendation line, that is correct.
What is there that shows us that the convening authority did not rely on the recommendation of the staff judge advocate?
Well, Your Honor, throughout the letter, the staff judge advocate gave the reasons why he was recommending the dismissal, and in those reasons stated that there was the ongoing investigation and that...
But that, again, gets to the same issue that Chief Judge Efron raised. We have two issues here. One is whether or not there was, in fact, a de facto dismissal. The second issue arises that if in fact there was some type of a dismissal, then was it for proper reasons? And then you can get into all of those other issues.
Yes, Your Honor. What I was trying to get to was in that portion of the letter, the SJA also stated that at the conclusion of this investigation, we may re-prefer. And the difference between a withdrawal and a dismissal is obviously that with a dismissal, you have to start anew. You have to start with a new preferral, a new investigation, a new referral. If you withdraw, then you can simply re-refer the charges.
Well, would you agree that the terms withdrawal and dismissal are terms of art?
Yes, Your Honor.
And how much importance should we give those? I mean, in other areas of the Uniform Code of Military Justice, if a convening authority says something, but there is an argument that he actually meant something else, we hold them to what they've said because we have those documents in front of us, and that's what the system relies on. Why shouldn't we do that here?
Well, Your Honor, I believe that in order to make a proper determination that all of the facts and circumstances should be taken into account. And the facts and circumstances in this case are that the convening authority, as well as the SJA, as well as the command of the accused, all acted in accordance with the dismissal by notifying the appellant charges were dropped, releasing him from active duty, allowing him to return home. Everything acted in accordance with a dismissal.
But if we do that, aren't we moving the line a little bit? Aren't we condoning and approving sloppy practice and saying it doesn't matter what you say here? You know, even though these are terms of art and do have importance in the military justice system, we're not going to pay attention to that, sending the message then to those practitioners out there that even though we're supposed to do this, we don't have to do that. They're going to let us get away with this. Isn't that the impact of this?
Well, Your Honor, I think that would be the impact if the letter to the convening authority had cited his options under RCM 604. However, in this case, he cited his options under the proper rule, and they acted in accordance with the proper rule. So really what you have is one document where the wrong, incorrect term was used in a regarding line and in a recommendation line. However, the understanding...
Well, actually, two documents. The recommendation and also the charge sheet where he wrote withdrawn.
Yes, Your Honor. I stand corrected. Right.
Where he wrote withdrawn, acting on the specific authority given to him by the convening authority.
Yes, Your Honor. However, the remaining case proceeded as if it was a dismissal.
Well, how it proceeded from that point on, I don't know if it is as important as to what the convening authority authorized. I think that's what we have to look at.
Let's stipulate without conceding on your part that the document is ambiguous. Is that, and as to whether it, what it is. In putting aside de facto dismissal, what law or principles of law should pertain to how we address ambiguity? Ambiguity in the context of speedy trial, in the context of liberty, in the context of whatever factors you want to put on the table. What guidance would you give this court in how we address ambiguity? In other contexts, for example, convening authority action is not clear or something, this court is divided, but there is law that says ambiguity can get sent back for clarification, for example. Why shouldn't that be the rule here, that in the absence of clarification X?
Well, I think that in the cases where there's ambiguity in a convening authority's action, for example, those are sent back because there is no further action by the convening authority to give guidance as to what that convening authority intended. Whereas in this case, you have consistent action from the moment he circled concur throughout the remaining case, the remainder of this case, as to what the convening authority intended on that day. And so I think that in looking at the complete and total facts and circumstances of the case, whereas in those two examples, a convening authority's action being ambiguous, there's nothing to follow to lead you in a manner to know what he was thinking.
So you would resolve this by saying the answer is you figure out, you ultimately conclude it's not ambiguous.
Yes, Your Honor.
Who struck through this thing? Let me try that more artfully. On the charge sheet, it's lined through. And we note that the lieutenant colonel wrote withdrawal, but whose line is that that struck through the charge?
My understanding is that it was the staff judge advocate's, the staff judge advocate that lined through the charge. But
that's your understanding, or you know that from the record, or you infer that from seeing how it's done? Or let me restate that. Is it the government's position that that's the convening authority's line?
May I have a moment?
You understand my question. My question is, who struck through
the actual line and not the initials?
Right. I don't. You can say we don't know, but or your answer is your business.
I'm just gonna. The actual line, I would say, is the staff judge.
In any event, you're not arguing that that's the convening authority's line.
There's no evidence that that's the convening authority's line.
You started by saying if there is de facto dismissal, or there is de facto dismissal for legitimate reason.
Yes, Your Honor.
Playing off of earlier questions that have been asked by all the judges, where does the legitimate reason come from in law?
Well, in this case, the military judge's findings of fact state that the SJA recognized his initial preferral on the 10th of September and the 10th of October was premature. And that was based on the testimony during this motion that OSI was continually talking to the legal office and specifically the staff judge.
I'm sorry, I may not be clear. Must the convening authority state a reason?
No, Your Honor. For de facto dismissal, there is no requirement.
Or for any kind of dismissal?
No, Your Honor. There is no requirement for a why.
And what is the government's position here as to what the reason for the dismissal was, putting aside whether there was a dismissal?
Well, the reason was that at the time, the dismissal was recommended to the convening authority, the staff judge advocate realized that the investigation was much more complex and had much more time needed to be completed, and therefore didn't actually understand the complete and total picture of the nature and seriousness of the offenses.
I got two more. Sorry, I'll get off the two more questions. Could the convening authority dismiss charges solely to stop the clock? As a conceptual matter?
I believe that under a dismissal, There's nothing that says that he could not do that to stop the clock.
Is the government contending today, and does the government seek from us a judgment that a convening authority can dismiss charges to stop the clock without more?
No, Your Honor, that's not what the government is proposing. In this case, the government is relying on the fact that there was a legitimate purpose for the convening authority to stop the clock.
And with respect to the investigation, does the record reflect whether the FBI and ATF's activities, however they're characterized, were known to the government prior to September 6th or September 10th?
No, Your Honor, the record does not reflect that. As a matter of fact, there was evidence right around, I believe the OSI investigator testified on the motion, that there was evidence right around the beginning of November where he was talking to the staff judge advocate and stating that evidence had just come out of the computer analysis, that they believed that there was going to be additional evidence out of the home computer evidence, and that had not yet been seized. And as a matter of fact, after the dismissal, there was additional evidence that was discovered based on the ongoing investigation, which did, as the military judge in this case, find.
It addresses the timeline issue, but that doesn't specifically address my question about the FBI-ATF investigation. That suggests that in November there was indication that there was more to learn at the home computer, but was that ATF and FBI doing that, or was that OSI?
That computer information was OSI, but ATF and the FBI, although it was not a joint investigation, were sharing information, and there was evidence that they had had interviews with people together because Pellant's name had come up in a circle regarding the selling of ammunition and other illegal activities through the Internet. So the evidence as far as a joint investigation was not found to be a joint investigation, but more of a cooperation and a concern on the Air Force's part regarding how much more is there going to be found in the FBI and ATF's investigation of other players that the appellant was involved with.
The defense brief in the court below, or at the trial court, specifically identified the issue of whether a actual dismissal occurred. Paragraph 6, they note that the defense response, in their view, conceded that no actual dismissal occurred, and they analyzed the government's position at trial in that fashion. So squarely before the military judge whether an actual dismissal occurred. The military judge has a lot of discussion. The military judge in his findings has a great deal of discussion about what he can assume that the SJA was or was not thinking in the case. Where in the military judge's findings does the military judge find that this convening authority dismissed these charges?
Your Honor, the only place that that's addressed, the military judge's findings of fact use the terms withdraw, and that's number 29. Then on 2 November 2001, a recommendation to withdraw charges was forwarded the convening authority by a signed letter. This letter stated, and then that's all that it provided the options.
Why doesn't the military judge have to determine that the convening authority, not the SJA, but the convening authority, dismissed the charges before the military judge then considers whether the dismissal was appropriate under 707 for purposes of stopping the speedy trial clock?
Well, Your Honor, it's the government's position that the convening authority concurred with the SJA's recommendation and that the SJA inartfully used the word withdraw, and therefore the military judge looked at the total facts and circumstances of the case to determine a de facto dismissal.
Again, then is the government agreeing that the military judge did not make a determination that this convening authority did in fact dismiss the charges? de facto dismissal means something else happened, and we're going to treat it as a dismissal.
The military judge does not state in his findings the fact that the commuting authority dismissed the charges.
And why shouldn't we require that? As a matter of stopping the speedy trial clock, that the convening authority, the only person who can dismiss charges, do so.
Well, because it's the government's position that the military judge analyzed it based on the facts and circumstances, and the facts were that the convening authority concurred with the recommendation to withdraw, although the recommendation letter gave the options that were under RCM 404, which included dismissal, and that withdrawal is not an option. And therefore, the judge gave the government, I guess, the deference that the term was used incorrectly, but the intent was always a dismissal, and that's what the convening authority acted on, but was the intent.
Is there any way that the convening authority could have agreed to withdraw the charges at that point in time?
No, Your Honor, because there was no referral to court-martial.
And so when he concurred with the decision of the staff judge advocate, if what the staff judge advocate was recommending to him was a withdrawal, he was agreeing to basically something that could not happen?
That's correct, Your Honor. And
so that action would be a nullity?
That's correct.
So nothing happened.
However,
are you stating that the military judge did not conclude that the charges had been dismissed?
I'm saying that there is no place in his findings of fact that specifically state the convening authority dismissed the charges.
De facto or otherwise?
In his findings of fact, there is no statement that says that. What it says is that the convening authority concurred with the recommendation to withdraw the charges, and that is what the military judge analyzed when looking at whether a de facto dismissal was here.
Where do you point to for the judge concluding that these charges were dismissed? The judge goes on to analyze the implication. Where does the judge conclude that the charges were dismissed, de facto or otherwise?
Yes, Your Honor.
I see a point on page 8 where it says it's obvious on the face of the letter that the SJA meant to recommend the charges be dismissed. Again, we're into the mind of the SJA here. What about the mind of the convening authority? Where do we find the judge saying here, I've looked at all this and I'm convinced that the convening authority dismissed these charges?
On page 7, Your Honor, at the top of the page, the first paragraph, the military judge stated the issue can be resolved by determining whether or not the concurrence of the convening authority on 6 November 2001 with the recommendation of the SJA to withdraw the charges was in reality a dismissal of the charges, and if so, whether or not the charges were dismissed for a legitimate reason.
Yeah, the military judge makes extensive use of passive voice. Things happen. We're dismissed. Looking for some active voice here. That the convening authority dismissed these charges, de facto or otherwise.
Well, in the next paragraph, he said that the convening authority the SJA intended to recommend dismissal rather than withdrawal. I understand that doesn't answer the question that you posed.
Do you have the record there? Can you take a look at page 246 of the record where the military judge apparently is making some legal conclusions and addresses that in paragraph 1 there? And I just guess I'd like your reaction to that in as a follow-up to Chief Judge Efron's question.
States that the act of lining out all the charges and specifications, notification to you that the charges had been dropped and your release from active duty resulted in a de facto dismissal of the charges against you on or about 6 November 2000.
And is what he's doing there is making conclusions of law based on the findings of fact that he had earlier made?
Yes, Your Honor.
I mean, does finding of fact number 37, that the accused was notified by Major Prescott, the support group commander, the charges against him been dropped, does that add anything to the analysis?
Well, in the discussion in 401C, it talks about that when charges are dismissed, the accuser and the accused should be informed. And that is a finding of fact that he was, in fact, informed not only by a member of his unit, but also by his defense counsel, that the charges had been dropped and he was released from active duty and sent home.
If charges are withdrawn, should the defendant ever be informed?
Well, there's nothing that says he couldn't be informed, but I don't believe that there's the same requirement under 604 as there is in 401.
But it wouldn't be unusual if charges were withdrawn that the defendant was informed.
No, it would not.
And the term dropped isn't exactly a legal term of art, although it appears to be used quite a bit.
Yes, Your Honor, that's correct. But in this case, all actions by the government were consistent with the dismissal. There was substantial compliance with the rules 404 and 401 for a dismissal, and the intent was clear that this was, in fact, meant to be a dismissal.
So then the import of what the military judge said on page 246 is that the convening authority didn't dismiss the charges in this case. That's why the military judge had to come up with this term or derive it from some other case law of the de facto dismissal.
Yes, Your Honor, the government's position is that he was looking at the total facts and circumstances based on the concurrence with the withdrawal, when in fact a withdrawal isn't possible under the rules as well as the facts of the case.
Is there a difference between, use our Latin here, de facto and de jure? Doesn't de facto mean it didn't happen as under law? That you're instead recognize that it happened in a passive sense. Somehow the charges were dismissed even though it wasn't done correctly under law?
Yes, Your Honor. De facto implies that it wasn't to the letter done correctly. However, the effect of it based on the compliance, the intent, and the facts and circumstances is that it was a dismissal and that it was done for a legitimate purpose. The investigation in this case was ongoing, and new matters came to the attention of the OSI, which were appropriately considered and which did result in major changes to the charges and specifications. Despite appellant's argument, the charges were not the same when they went forward at trial. There were some major changes to the charges, including the adding of federal gun charges under Article 134, adopting 18 U.S.C. 922.
Can I ask a quick question about the charges?
Yes, Your Honor.
Can you tell me why the charges related to the apparent focus of the additional investigation were withdrawn after arraignment?
Yes, Your Honor, it was part of the pretrial agreement. During the motion portion of the trial, for whatever reasons, the appellant became concerned with lengthy confinement and with convictions for the most serious offenses, and therefore they negotiated a pretrial agreement that the government would agree to take the most serious offenses off the table in exchange for guilty pleas to the remaining offenses.
Where is that reasoning indicated in the record?
It's in the affidavit provided by the defense counsel at the lower court. Wherein they entered into pretrial agreement negotiations, and he secured a pretrial agreement capping his confinement at 6 months, taking dishonorable discharge off the table, and the government in exchange agreed to withdraw the four most serious specifications upon his plea of guilty. That's why those charges were withdrawn at trial.
Does the accused derive any advantage from having charges dismissed?
Yes, Your Honor, he does. And in this case, the appellant was in his civilian life was in the security business. And based on that, he taught arms classes and carried a weapon, and, you know, had a license to carry a weapon and to perform those duties. And if he had been convicted of federal drug crimes, then that would...
Not talking about conviction, just the act of dismissal. Assuming that the convening authority did dismiss the charges on November 6th, what advantage did that have for the accused? aside from the disadvantage of having the speedy trial clock stop? What advantage did that bring to the accused at that point?
He got to go home. He got to be released from active duty and go home to his wife and live a civilian life while the government went on with their investigation in this case, which took another 6 months. So for that 6 months, instead of being held on active duty, he was allowed to go home and continue with his civilian life.
Am I correct that if the government had chosen to in this case, it could have not preferred any charges at all in September and held this person on active duty from the time they first suspected that he had done something until such point in time as they had a complete investigation done, even if it was 2 years down the road?
Yes, Your Honor. They could have held him on active duty and pending an investigation. That is correct. Well, if there's no further questions, I will briefly conclude. The military judge did not err when he found de facto dismissal for legitimate purpose in this case, and therefore there was no violation of RCM 707, Article 10, or the Sixth Amendment. The appellant received effective assistance from trial defense counsel and entered provident pleas of guilty, wherefore he benefited from the bargain that he chose to make. Accordingly, the government asked this court affirm the Air Force Court's findings and sentence. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Does the defense have rebuttal?
First, I'd kind of just like to clear up the facts that counsel was stating in regards to the pretrial agreement. Specifically in defense counsel Vaughn's statement, he stated that the reason for the pretrial agreement was that Tippett was very anxious to return home to his wife and newborn baby. That was simply it. And that was something that was within the record the entire time, that he wanted to be with his wife and newborn baby.
So can you tell me why the charges were withdrawn after arraignment?
Why the charges were withdrawn after?
After arraignment. I mean, when I look at the charge sheet, all the charges that appear to have been the subject of the investigations that took additional time here were withdrawn after arraignment, and I'm asking you if you know why.
There's nothing within the record that would state why those charges, besides the fact that it was part of the pretrial agreement. Also, for the FBI and the ATF information, they were involved from June 2001, and specifically on pages of the record of trial 175, on page 175, it states that during the examination, and the only thing that the FBI did after the 2nd of November 2001 was just provide the LSI a copy of what little media analysis they had done on the computer seized at Staff Sergeant Tippett's residence in Arizona. They provided a copy of that to the OSI, and the answer from the OSI agents is that's correct. So that shows what the FBI's involvement was at that time as of 2 November. And also on page 198 of the record of trial and 197 of the record of trial. 197 speaks in regards to the FBI agents working with OSI to search the residence of Staff Sergeant Tippett, where they found the additional charge, the Colt AR-15 lower receiver, and they found that in June 2001, well prior to 2 November 2001, which was one of the reasons why the government argued in their response to the defense's request for dismissal, or request for the charges to the violation of the Article 1707. And also on page 198, they stated that the number one reason why the additional investigation wasn't done because they did not want to interfere with the FBI's investigation. So clearly there had been interaction with the FBI, and much of the evidence had been found prior to November 2001 in relationship to the charges that were later re-preferred in the new additional charges. Also, within RCM 604, which discusses withdrawal of charges, in the analysis of that within the MCM, it states that withdrawal of charges extinguishes jurisdiction of the court martial. Dismissal extinguishes the charges themselves. There is no, these charges were never extinguished. The SJA knew that they wanted to continue with these charges and clearly stated that to the convening authority. And there's no evidence that the only thing the convening authority did was sign on the SJA's memorandum that he concurred and initialed that. And that's, I believe it's appellate exhibit number 4. There was a question about the advantage to the accused while he was released. However, the problem was it was a disadvantage for the accused to be released in some respect because he was told that these charges were dropped and that he was sent home not serving any duty during that time, not basically as U.S. v. Britain states that they should be placed back on their full duty as a service member.
Well, he was a reservist.
Correct.
He was a reservist, so let's not make arguments that you don't need to make here. I mean, he was a reservist and he had a day job.
Correct. He was a reservist. However, he had prior to been serving reserve duty during the months prior to then extending him out again. So while he was released, he didn't serve any reserve duty. So that clearly goes, he was not placed back on as if he was a reservist. He was not serving any duty during that time frame from his release on 6 November 2001 to the time that he was recalled in June 2002.
Is there something in the record that shows that that was done because he was subject to investigation or potentially referral of charges?
There is nothing in the record that demonstrates
that. Okay, thank you.
But within the record, the appellant did testify that he had not done any duty. So while the government's perfecting their case between 6 November 2001 and 5 June 2002, appellant is back home living his life and not.
Well, let's again be clear. He's a reservist who was on active duty when he was at the military base, and he was released from that active duty status, which it sounds like he wanted to be, correct?
Correct. Yes, sir. But it also would be prejudiced against him, and one of the number one, based on Ms. Gala, the three things that would go against an individual, number one is preparation for their case, and if the government's able to perfect their case, knowing that they, at the time that they withdrew, at the time that the charges were withdrawn and he was sent home, not informing him that the case was still ongoing, he was still left without preparing his defense for his case.
And when he left, the investigation was ongoing. The case was not ongoing.
I would say by the intent, it's clear by the intent of the SJA that this case was going forward, that they wanted to re-prefer the charges as soon as the investigation was complete. And based on all their actions, this case really never stopped. Although they attempted to withdraw the charges, this case was still ongoing. These charges, he was still technically facing these charges.
And okay, so you want us to take facing these charges, the language in Britain, to mean that that you are the focus of an investigation with an intent to prefer charges once you're finished?
No, not. I would say specifically for this case, it's unique, one, because he is a reservist, and two, because based on the actions of the government, he was still, they didn't start the case anew. They continued with the same charges, the same offenses, and the investigation, although they stated, was continuing based on a computer media analysis. When you look at the OSI's testimony, the majority of the evidence that they had, and also when you look at the Article 32 investigation, that was all evidence that they had prior to 6 November or 2 November 2001.
So the language in Britain that quote that the accused no longer faces charges, what does that language mean in your view?
What that language means is a dismissal.
What does that language mean?
that he no longer faces the charges, that he will not have to defend against these charges in the future.
What are the charges? I mean, that's what I'm trying to understand. You keep on talking about him facing charges and the prejudice to him. What do you mean by the charges? Do you mean, you know, that a suspicion that criminal activity has occurred? Do you mean, you know, an intent to prefer charges in the future? Charges has a very specific meaning, and it doesn't mean, I don't think, what you seem to think it means, which is that a suspicion that criminal activity occurred.
The original preferred charges, and when you take the original preferred charges from 10 September 2001 and the charges that were preferred later on in 2002, those are essentially, although the wording's different, they're essentially the same charges with the same evidence that supported them, and that's clear based on the Article 32 investigating officer's analysis of those charges.
Okay, so in your view, someone could be facing charges even if there's no charges currently preferred. Is that what you're saying? I'm just trying to get an answer.
No, Your Honor. Based on the fact that they preferred charges on 10 September 2001, that charge sheet that he received from 10 September 2001 and the charge sheet that he received from 10 October 2001, the additional charge, when you marry those charges up with the charge sheets that he received from the charges that were preferred against him in 2002...
Okay, so just... To recap, then, you believe that an accused can be faced, that this appellant was facing charges even on September 20th of 2002, even though at that point in time the charges had either been withdrawn or dismissed?
On November 20th? Yes, Your Honor.
And your basis for that is because charges were preferred against him in 2002 that you think looked similar.
The basis for that is the intent of the clearly from the intent of the SJA. They were continuing the case.
Okay, I understand your position.
I see that my time is up.
You're welcome to briefly conclude your argument.
Staff Sergeant Tippett's speedy trial rights have been violated under RCM 707 and Article 10. Unfortunately, did not get to the Article 10 issue today, but there can be no denial by the government that they made many mistakes and errors in Staff Sergeant Tippett's case. Unfortunately for Staff Sergeant Tippett, those errors violated his rights and prejudiced him, specifically because he was a reservist. And furthermore, his trial defense counsel made errors that were detrimental to Staff Sergeant Tippett and his rights. The Air Force Court's dissenting opinion says it best. The facts and circumstances supporting dismissal for speedy trial violations in this case are grounded entirely in the government's persistent ineptitude. Having preferred charges against the appellant no less than four times already, the government should not rightfully be heard to complain about being denied a fifth bite at the apple, nor would there be any negative impact on the administration of justice in bringing this case finally to a close. Respectfully protect Staff Sergeant Tippett's rights and properly bring this case finally to a close, finding that his RCM 707 rights were violated and his Article 10 rights were violated. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. And we thank counsel for both parties for your presentation today. The case is now submitted and the court will be adjourned.